I believe the two most powerful words in business are just ask.
From a base of 200 billion of assets, my target in 5 years was to get us to 300.
We struck the oil in 69, the day before Christmas Eve. On the last attempt, bang, found the oil.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time. And he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. Peter Harrison, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with the early days, and so maybe we could talk a little bit about growing up, where I think you grew up in Cheshire. Tell me a little bit about your childhood.
Early days, I don't remember a great deal. I remember being sent away to school at the age of seven, which was a forming experience. We sort of very, very tough boarding school, which put out a lot of rugby teams, a lot of cross-country teams, and we did nothing but sport and a modest amount of education. I then was a bit of a rebel, so my father was absolutely clear that I was going to go to Cambridge and read theology. So I found the one university that did business administration in the country, much to his disgust, and became not a lawyer, which was the one thing I had to become, either a lawyer or an accountant. I think it took him about 30 years to get over the fact I didn't join a professional services firm.
But business administration back in the 80s was an unusual route. Was that just rebellion or was it an early fascination?
I'd love to say it was an early fascination. It was quite a lot of rebellion and something that was just interesting.
Great. Well, that's terrific. So you finish your degree, and then how do you think about the subject of work? How do you go about it?
Not only was business administration very unfashionable, but placements, industrial placements were really unfashionable. And I did two, one working for Brown & Root, Conoco, and a sort of an offshore gas project. And the other one working for Samuel Montague on their what were then third-generation swaptions, and sitting on the trading floor. And I absolutely loved it. Nearly hadn't gone back and done my final year. It was very obvious I was either going to join Samuel Montague or another city firm. And I walked into the careers office at Bath, and they said, "No, we've never sent anyone to the city." And there were literally no files, and of course there was no internet. So I found the addresses for the 13 accepting houses and wrote to them. And Schroders was foolish enough to respond.
Fantastic. And when you pitch up there, what are you told to do?
So October 88, so many firms hadn't taken anybody because of the crash the prior year. So they'd all got rid of their graduate training programs. So I was the social experiment, actually, because in the previous years, Schroders had just hired from Oxford and Cambridge. And this was the year they hired four people from non-Oxbridge backgrounds. And we were all sent off to asset management. So I was a very early diversity candidate.
Fantastic. And what were you actually asked to do?
So I joined, well, as with most graduates, you join very quickly the research department. So I did a little bit of time in finance, first of all, because I could code. And there were few computers arriving in the firm. So I was asked to figure out what these computers did. And then I went to the research department. I was an engineering analyst. And then quite shortly after, the water industry was privatized, and then the electricity industry. So I really made my mark as an analyst, understanding utilities, which was a prospectus of about 1,000 pages where you had to learn industry structure, but there was a vast amount of money to be made very early on. So it was quite easy to make your mark in those days.
Fantastic. So Schroders welcome you and you give you a, what sounds like quite an interesting job. And then 3 years later, you jump ship. Is that right?
I had been told by one of the firm managers that the job of an analyst was to make sure the pencils were always sharp in the meeting rooms when companies came in. And I was a bit of a young man in a hurry and I still had a bit of a rebellious streak. And I got a call from a firm that at the time no one had ever heard of. It was five people down Borough High Street called Newton. And I met this chap, Stuart Newton, who seemed absolutely fascinated that somebody from Schroders would even talk to him. And I was taken by him. He was a fascinating man. So I joined Newton. And I never forget going to resign. I gave him my letter, and very senior manager at Schroders took one look at it and said, that's unacceptable. People don't resign from Schroders. No one ever teaches you how to resign.
So you moved to Newton, and then you obviously have ended up, and we'll talk about that in a little while, managing the firm rather than managing the money. But in those early days, what were you doing?
Newton made its top money as a genuine global investor without lots of emphasis on risk control. Go anywhere, do anything. So we literally ran funds all over the world. So I would have big positions in Thailand or in sip and step warrants in Italy, et cetera, which was fascinating. But it was a small firm, so we all did a bit of general management. And we went through a major merger at the time with Capital House. And so I got a little bit involved in management. And when I went to Fleming's, Newton was bought by Royal Bank of Scotland and the culture changed. And so I went off to Fleming's and I was asked to run the research department as well as run money. And that gave me a bit of sense of people management, but it was another 5 years really before I gave up running money, and that was a very strange feeling.
I mean, we work in an industry, the investment management industry typically drives the young person into a sales, analytical sort of trading role, but not usually training them to be a manager. Was there a sense that you wanted to do this more than managing the money, or was it just sort of happenstance?
Peter principle that we all end up with our own level of incompetence in a hierarchy. Right. We had some great performance numbers and we started doing a lot of marketing. And the more time I spent on the road, the more I realized there were young guys in the office who knew a lot more than I did about the stock names. And bit by bit, I found myself looking at my emails before my Bloomberg in the mornings. And you gradually slip out of it. And it took me, it's the Bloomberg test, that what do you turn on first in the morning? You turn your Bloomberg on or your emails? And I found myself turning my emails on. And before you know it, there's going to be someone better than you.
That's very interesting. So then tell me about the next move.
Fleming's was bought by JP Morgan. And so I spent 4 or 5 years seeing the challenges of corporate mergers in our industry, which really deserve a whole podcast all by themselves. They're not happy. I was then approached to go and be the CIO of Deutsche's asset management businesses, of which there were five. And it was very clear to me very quickly that that was not a home for me. And a lot of the talent had up and gone. There was a lot of investment bankers working there, and it just felt like it was not going to work. And in fact, history shows it didn't work for many years. So I stayed there a couple of years and I made the mistake of basically retiring. My wife said after a couple of months, I had to go and find something to do. And I didn't know anything other than fund manager. So I thought, why not set up your own little thing and have people who you know and like and all work together, and you can have a very exciting little business. In those days, the barriers to entry were way lower than they were. This was 2006. So we started off, there was a little existing business, but we quite literally went to IKEA, bought some shelves. I remember sitting on the floor, screwing together toilet roll holders with my then 2-year-old, and we got up and running.
Fantastic. And so you do that for a while, and yet the sort of the former mothership Schroders comes back into your life.
We did that for 6 years and we built it up, and the assets grew and lots of learnings when you do a bit of everything. But after 5 years, we needed to find a sensible shareholder for some of the smaller shareholders to exit. And I knew Mike Dobson at Schroders, and I went along and had a conversation with him and said, why don't you become a shareholder, minority shareholder? And he said, yeah, that's fine. And quite literally, we shook hands on a deal. And 3 weeks later, that was a deal we did. So I was then still running the business for about another year and a half. And Mike Dobson saying to me most days, why don't you come and work for Schroders? Why would I want to do that? You know, I work in the West End. I've got a lovely lifestyle. And then I'd never forget, I was walking on the cliffs in 2012 Christmas. And my then 10-year-old son said to me, Dad, what would you do if they stopped asking you? And the insecurity of me, about 3 months later, I started work at Schroders.
Fantastic. Well, I think the FT described Schroders a while ago as the aristocrat of the UK investment management industry. But it is unusual. It's family backed. It's got quite a large family shareholding. Tell me a little bit about how it feels.
So the family owned 47%. And the Schroeder family is a very small and tight-knit family, which is two sides, the Schroeders and the Mallinckrodts. But fundamentally, they've been long-term supporters of the business over five generations, going back to the beginning of the 1800s. And that gives us an ability to not think like a public company. We can think genuinely for the long term. And I'll tell the story 100 times, but Bruno Schroeder, bless him, sat on our board for 56 years. And he sat in the same seat and he used to look up and say, just get it right on a 20-year view. The philosophy was very clear. You hand over the business to executive management and you give them the rein and you back them for the long term. And you couldn't ask for a nicer, more consistent, supportive shareholder.
How terrific. So I'd like to quiz you a little bit about the global asset management business beyond the sort of the turbulence of the immediate sort of backdrop. And maybe you can talk a little bit about the challenges in the institutional asset management space.
So many people talk about the challenges in the industry, and whether it be the rise of passive, falling fees, people moving from defined benefit schemes that were in equities into a lot of fixed income and LDI. And anyone would have thought that this was an industry that wasn't one of the most profitable industries left in the world. I always joke, it's the most profitable industry that no one's ever heard of. I see lots and lots of corners of growth, but it's different from the growth that we had in the past. So if you go back in time when you and I started work, it was everybody followed something called the CAPS median, or WM median, which was a benchmark of collective funds. And then we went to specialist benchmarks, then we went through LDI. But now there are new growth areas. So institutions increasingly passing over all of their balance sheet to be run by a manager. They're growing their private assets very considerably. They want very different Solvency II's created very different problems for insurance companies who want you to solve their Solvency II problem, not their benchmark problem. So we're seeing our business grow in new areas, but the traditional index plus two business is definitely challenged. But you've got to be very good at it.
So let's break that down, if we may. And thank you for saying that we're of a similar age, because I know that that's actually flatters me enormously. But let's talk a little bit about the alternative part of your business and how you're thinking about it.
So effectively, there's three areas of our business where there's lots of easy runway ahead. One of them is the wealth business, and we can come back and talk about that. The other is a private markets business. And the third is a solutions business, where we look after the whole of a client's problems. If we take the private markets and alternatives business, that includes everything from looking at catastrophe insurance right the way through to running hotels, real estate, private equity, private debt, infrastructure funding. And what it's characterized by is one-off bigger fundraisings from a range of sophisticated institutions around the world where the money gets tied up for 7, 8, 9 years. And you really have to trust in the manager and the way they're going to go about doing things. And we've acquired a number of capabilities in that area over the last 3 or 4 years. And we've seen good follow-on growth from all of them. There is a new business we've just added called Blue Orchard, which I think is particularly interesting, which is microfinance, which has taken hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and is having a really positive impact with development agencies. And that, for me, is the really exciting bit of putting a purpose back into finance.
And how have you built that?
Blue Orchard was originally set up by the United Nations. So blue because it's the colour of the United Nations, and orchard because that's what's in the back garden of the UN in Geneva. So on the ground, credit officers lending to microfinance institutions has lent to about 46 million people, will typically make loans of $50 or $100. So the story I love most, a true story of Mrs. Soam, who was on the rubbish dumps of Phnom Penh, and literally she borrowed $50 so she could collect rubbish direct from stores rather than off the rubbish dumps. She then came back and took a further loan of $500 to build a shelter and another $500 to get some distribution and put a roof over the shelter. Today, she employs 6 people. She's rehoused her 13 family. They've all got medical care, and she makes about $4,000 a profit. She was on the rubbish dumps. Now she's a proper entrepreneur, backed through 3 small microfinance loans. And if anyone says that finance doesn't have a purpose and doesn't do good, that Mrs. Soam is an epitome of what we can achieve. And the fund that lending sits in offers LIBOR plus 500 in a regulated format that people would recognize and look at. And you think, actually, you know, that is where the puck is going. That is the new exciting frontier that we can see actual positive impact from what it is that we're doing every day.
Well, that's very interesting. So let's move to the individual segment, because some of the underlying products will come back to be relevant. But as far as I see it, your high net worth business is branded Cazenove Capital Management, and you bought business of Hoare & Co along the way. And then you have this other business, which is the deal with Lloyds. Should we maybe talk a little bit about those
two? I mean, fundamentally, they're all driven by wanting to be close to the consumer. The reality is that there were some structural changes that happened in the industry a few years ago called RDR, which has meant a very large disintermediation between manufacturers and suppliers. And I'm always very struck by a study done in the US by Dalbar that says the average US mutual fund holder gets a return of half the index. And they do that because they buy high and sell low. And you can see it in the turnover of UK mutual funds that you see lots of hot money coming in at the top and lots of money going out at the bottom. Our simple philosophy is if you can own the customer, you can keep them in the bad times, help them buy the dips, get them to rebalance and focus on their goals, and you can genuinely grow their wealth. So the closer you are to the customer, the greater the longevity and the better the financial outcome. And we don't want to be disintermediated. So we've been expanding our wealth business at the ultra high net worth and the high net worth end with Cazenove and Hoare. And then in the mass affluent world with this joint venture with Lloyds. And that's interesting because what we're doing is we're taking the referrals from Lloyds, adding them with some good technology, which we happen to own, and Schroeder's investment proposition. And the combination of those working with the referrals will be, I think, help fill that advice gap which exists in the UK. The staggering statistics are that we have a population of 65 million people in the UK. And I think today there are something like, and there's only 29,000 financial advisors in the country, and their average age is 59. So it's no wonder we've got an advice gap, and technology and growing new advisors through academies will be the answer to that.
Interesting. Now, can we talk a little bit about the portfolio composition and how that's changing? Because the classic sort of 60-40 clearly has been invalidated or made less applicable in the world in which, you know, we have no yield on cash. And that, of course, is encouraging some people to take perhaps more risk than they might have done in less liquid pools. Maybe just talk a little bit about how you think.
I do worry that we've been in an extended period of the cycle with rates ridiculously low. No one's ever really got their heads around how you deal with negative rates. And that's led to some very covenant light challenges because lots of lending's gone on and too much money has been raised in private credit funds that they're going to really struggle to put to work. And then we have a shock to the system and cash flows stop dead and there aren't the covenants to support it. And you're going to see an awful lot of stress that comes out of that because old rules apply. History repeats itself.
So, a private client portfolio in 10 years' time, how, just give me a sense of what you think the asset allocation might look like.
I think you're going to see a bigger growth in real assets. So I think that finding ways to match people's goals will change. I think that too often the answer to every question has been 60-40. And increasingly, I think people will say, well, actually, let's be really extreme. Let's say I give you an iPad and it's got 17 UN Sustainable Development Goals on it, and you say, these are the ones that are important to me. And you play a little game that gives you me your risk profile and your aversion to loss and some sense of your time frame. And then you build a portfolio that's bespoke to those issues of belief and issues of value. Yes, that will surely generate, you know, be generating almost certainly some income, but I will think we'll still have a good chunk of equities in it, but it will have a tilt towards things that are specific and real to you. But I think increasingly it'll have assets that you can relate to. So it maybe have school infrastructure or water infrastructure, probably owned through some form of fractional ownership on a bit of blockchain that will look very different from today.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick pause. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, chief executive of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, BordeauxIndex.com/LiveTrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintus. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintus is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon, and Basquiat. Actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintus and think it merits a closer look. Well, that sort of brings us into the subject of ESG, which is on almost everybody's lips in the investing sort of, you know, arena. I mean, how do you think about this, and particularly how do you think about trying to avoid it becoming simply a box-ticking exercise?
I think too often it has become a box-ticking exercise, and I think it's the G gets a huge amount of emphasis because it's easy to tick boxes on G, and the S gets very little attention because it's hard, i.e. the social bit, even though there's still 25 million people in modern-day slavery, but it doesn't get the attention it deserves. And the climate's getting a lot more attention these days, but it's hard. My slightly controversial view is ESG won't exist in 5 years' time. It'll be what people are expected to do. I think the debate will move on to impact. If you think about it, 15 years ago, we talked about corporate mission, and then we talked about values, and then we talked about culture, and then we talked about purpose. And I think that purpose is already starting to wane, and impact is really what people need. What's the externalities of what I'm doing? What's the positive I'm giving back? How do you measure that? That's where the puck is going. So ESG is the big buzzword of the moment, but I suspect everybody wants to be there. So it'll rapidly get commoditized.
And I suppose my question is, how do you help direct and shape the organization so it is there?
You've got to green the whole system. ESG is not something that you do on the side or at the end. It is embedded in every single investment process, and every single investment decision is made against it. And every single portfolio is measured for impact. And his exposure to all the risks. And we've got about 150 different data sources we're taking from around the world to measure this stuff. Because I think what is changing is the days of people waving their hands around, painting the walls green and saying, we're woke, they've gone. And we are actually now getting into the hard reality of numbers. And it's not signing up for numbers off MSCI or something like that. This is proper, real analysis. And that is going to be the new arms race of the data around ESG. That's where it's going to go. But it will go from ESG into impact.
And is that creating actually a sort of a barrier to some that, who don't have the resources?
Yeah, that's certainly my hope. No, we've thrown a large number of people at it because we do think that actually, if you can get this right, it becomes genuinely differentiating.
Right, right. We talked a little bit about this diversification away from public markets, but underlying that is some of the challenges for the public markets. And I'm meaning by that increased regulation, growing public scrutiny, diminishing liquidity. How do you think about the stock markets and their purpose versus, you know, how we always thought about them?
You make a very good point. The number of public companies has halved in the last 20 years. And if you look at the trend, it's clearly downwards. You look at the number of companies held by PE, it's very clearly upwards. And if you look at the rise of new private permanent capital vehicles, that's going up very strongly. So there is clearly something not right about public markets. And part of it is regulation, part of it is governance, part of it's short-termism, part of it's transparency and scrutiny. And the reality is that actually private equity has become a very sophisticated, well-run, thoughtful business that isn't the Wild West. Then these are not drive-by shootings, these are good long-term owners. And it's offering a real alternative to public markets. And I think that will only grow. And I think on the flip side of it, you need to think about how do we make fractions out of some big assets so that we give retail investors access to more interesting things. Because today, if you buy the FTSE 100, you buy a lot of banks, a lot of oil companies, a lot of heavy, high carbon, old industries. And that's not, if you're a defined contribution saver into the UK, buying a UK index fund, that is not the portfolio that you want. You've got no technology, you've got no growth. So we need to think really hard about what people are defaulting into in their savings. Otherwise, they're going to end up with a lot of the old world and they're going to miss all the interesting companies that aren't privately.
Right. But at the lower market cap level, you have small companies who might be the future large companies who are struggling with some of the things we've talked about. What would be your advice to either the regulators or what would you encourage government to do in this regard?
Two or three things. One is we've got to change the listing rules so that companies can come to the UK, even if we've lost some really big companies that decided not to list in the UK because our listing rules are too onerous because you couldn't have protected share classes, etc. I think we've got to be open for business on that one. The second is we've got to have some vehicles that allow people to save into non-traditional listed FTSE 100 companies. And so finding those vehicles which allow people to, and the Treasury are working on some of those vehicles now, something called the Long-Term Asset Fund is coming through. And that will enable people to save into vehicles with slightly less liquidity, but will enable them to not have the mark-to-market volatility, which is often the thing that frightens people out at the bottom. If you're a DC saver for 25 years, you don't need daily price funds. So we've got to break the stranglehold of platforms forcing everyone to have daily price funds, because that is a huge cost to the consumer for no apparent benefit.
Right. So we talked about the UK. Schroders has always had a strong footprint in Asia. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing there and what you're seeing, more importantly, in terms of appetite?
Yeah, so the vast majority of our business actually is outside the UK, or the majority of it rather, and the biggest part of that is Asia. And what you see now is very rapid development. I mean, cash disappeared in China in 6 months. It's taking us much longer, but you're seeing a vast amount of innovation. But we're doing the same things in those areas that we're doing over here. So we've partnered, for example, in China and India with large banks, as we've done with Lloyds over here, to be closer to the end consumer. And we're seeing rapid growth in those businesses. We're working very closely with big distributors in the more mature markets, Hong Kong, Singapore, to help give income products, etc. We're growing our wealth business in Singapore because we see many of the same characteristics that we've seen over here. But fundamentally, Asia is a really, really exciting place. There's lots of wealth generation, there's lots of dynamism, there's people embrace technology. And I think we'll be the first place in the world to go to mass customization. The sorts of personalized portfolio that I was talking about earlier in terms of shaping it to your specific goals and needs, Asia's leading the way on that. That's something that we want to be a part of.
I think you've told me before that you have built a bank of data scientists or a large team of data scientists. Tell me a little bit about what your thinking's been and what you've done.
When I first joined Schroders, I was given a report and accounts, some trade press, some broker notes, and a spreadsheet to analyze the company. And the spreadsheet was Lotus 123. Well, when I rejoined 25 years later, everything was the same except Lotus had been discontinued and Excel had started, but everything else was the same. And it just felt to me that the amount of information in the world had grown exponentially and we were not being able to tap into it because it was just too big, too complicated. We weren't giving people the tools. So we stuck 25 data scientists in the middle of the investment floor, said it's a free resource, and told them to go and disrupt what we were doing. And they bought lots of interesting alternative bits of data. And I give you a simple example. The brand database that we have, which is pretty well every brand in every country and how it's developing over time, I think is something like 30 billion rows long. Well, you can't give that to a portfolio manager and say, go figure. You need a data scientist sitting with them to help them interpret it. And once you start, there's so much rich data that you can help to understand insights. So this is not about running quant funds. This is about giving fundamental analysts really good insights into what's going on in businesses and doing that through understanding alternative sorts of data, often unstructured data.
Now, we saw over the last three, 4 decades, the rise of the star manager who's sort of, you know, single operator often under the roof of the institution who then went and moved off. Has it become much more difficult for single star managers to evolve now because of the need for data?
Two things. I think the star manager was very much a UK phenomenon. It was much less an international phenomenon. But it's become more difficult, A, because of barriers to entry, partly regulation, partly data. Partly the level of competition is just so intense. So if you think there's 800 funds, European equities. So in order to be top quartile, you're going to be one of the top 200. How many are going to be really differentiating? So you've got a 3, 4, 5 year wait just to build your track record. That's a big, big cost for an individual to bear when they're setting up their own business. So it happens occasionally. But if you look today, the big blockbuster funds tend all to come from big institutions.
So we touched on it, but maybe just your thoughts on how fees are diverging across the industry and across products.
If you go back 5 years, active management round numbers was 75 basis points. Passive was, let's say, 40 basis points. Today, passive is round number zero, and active has come down a bit. So active is going to come down quite a bit more in order to bridge that gap. And people's ability to say what is genuine alpha is also got a lot better because you've got a lot more computing power to do it, and it's very transparent. So people will still pay for skill, but what people won't pay for is luck, a bit of a fund manager who's followed a trend, something which is discernibly style rather than genuine skill. So idiosyncratic skill, particularly in places where you need a lot of resource, so emerging markets, very, very little fee pressure. Big commoditized markets where there's very little evidence of alpha, like the US, huge fee pressure. And I think that's going to carry on.
So the Schroders of tomorrow, how do you think about that?
I think increasingly when we compete for the big, difficult mandates, we only really compete with two or three other firms. And it's the same two or three names the whole time. And we've been winning those battles. So we will increasingly solve the big, complicated problems for insurance companies, for pension funds. We will increasingly be able to differentiate ourselves because we do everything. So we can do the private markets piece. We can do the Solvency II optimization and reporting. And we can understand the trends that are emerging across all the global markets. That's going to squeeze the middle intensely because not many people are able to play that game. Technology is going to play a bigger and bigger role. We've doubled our tech spend over the last 3 years. Again, not many people can afford to do that. And that is enabling us to do more and more interesting and different things. So I think the gap between winners and losers is clearly getting a lot, lot wider. I think the icing on the cake for us will be success in private markets and success in wealth, because not only have we got this very strong institutional core of the business, but we've also got two really interesting growth businesses on top.
And what's your biggest challenge trying to lead this and shift culture?
It's always going to be around having and maintaining the very best people. So we've been very fortunate. We have very, very low levels of staff turnover. We've got a great collaborative environment, and it sounds rather trite because everyone says it, but we've put a huge amount of effort in creating a leading working environment. So we put doctors, dentists, gyms, tech bars, concierge, so that people want to come to work and they really, really like being in the building. Massive staircases so they can walk everywhere. Little things like that that make, we've even got a licensed bar in the building. But people come in and they feel proud to be a part of the firm. That ultimately is your ability to hire talent. And if you can hire talent, all these other problems are solvable.
And I think I read you have a sort of over 90% happy staff ratio, which obviously puts you sort of
proud to be associated with it.
But what particularly do you think has been the Peter Harrison stamp?
In terms of our people, we've made two big pushes in the last 3 years. One is about more diversity and inclusion. I mean, I passionately believe that good teams have lots of different perspectives. Too often it gets watered down into gender diversity. And actually, that for me is the least important lens. Neural diversity is what you really want. Different backgrounds, different ways of thinking. Getting diverse and getting that included. So people talk about diversity and inclusion. Inclusion is more important than diversity. That's one. And the second is an understanding of the mental well-being of what it means to be in this industry. It's tough. We've seen it. We see it on a regular basis. We have booms and busts, and it does for people. And so being able to pick up the pieces and being there for the long term, I think, is a big differentiator that we, our long-term perspective affords us that luxury. But I think that, for me, has been a big investment and well worth it.
What haven't you been able to achieve so far that you wanted to?
Well, goodness me, my to-do list is longer today than the day I arrived. But it takes a long time to change from we had a very traditional institutional business, which was very good at doing it better, faster, quicker. We've got to grow Asia much more. We've got to grow wealth much more. We've got to grow private market solutions. We've got a long way to travel on diversity. We've got lots more tools to get in people's hands. And having invested in technology, we've got to get people using it. So there's a long, long way to go. But what we've also clear about is that strategy really matters. So I think gone are the days when you can go in a straight line. You've got to adapt. And we've changed the business immensely strategically. We will keep on making those pivots. What we will never do is that big merger where we slam two cultures together and send all the wrong signals to our staff. So I think almost it's, we're clear what we want to do, but we're very clear what we don't want to do.
Yeah, no, well, I can say I saw that at Morgan Stanley when Team Widow was merged. So we've got an audience of students as well and people thinking about their careers, and I'd like to just switch tack. It was sort of, we used to talk about go east, my boy or my girl. Where do you go now?
I still think go east is a really good recommendation, actually. But there's huge opportunities in financial advice. There's still a huge gap in financial advice in our industry in the UK. And over time, the automation of financial advice and adding technology to that is going to be the big thing. There's a lot to do in customization, thinking through what people's goals are. No one wakes up in the morning needing MSCI World as a benchmark. They have a problem that needs solving. And our industry has never expressed itself in terms of the problems. There's a great deal to do there. The distribution challenges are getting much, much more complicated. We talk about the cable industry where you have the wires and the content. Our industry is going through its little thing, thinking about who owns the wires and how valuable really is the content. So there's a lot to do there for people. But fundamentally, I think the most interesting challenges in our industry are still the investment challenges, figuring out which are the great businesses and which are going to grow. That will be a perennial head scratcher. The computers will never really be able to do that for us over any meaningful time frame.
So what do you look for in a graduate today?
I look for differences. So when we're bringing people in, we're looking for people who complement what we've got at the moment. So we tend to be looking for a lot of STEM skills. But that's not because STEM skills are inherently better. It's just that we're generally light of them in our industry. We're looking for people who are of the utmost integrity, looking for people who are comfortable in their own skin. So they really feel, they don't feel the need to live a different person in the office. If you think of the mental health challenge we're all under, the person who wants to be something different in the office and different at home, they're tough enough to be one person, never mind two. We're looking for people who are street smart.
So that's interesting. So I guess that leads me to a slightly different question is, what do you know today that you really wish you'd known 30 years ago?
I think context, that everything happens in a context, that when you step back from it, you see these patterns, you see these repetitions. And if you can understand the bigger picture, so many of the little things that happen make sense. When you're running at it, as I was, you know, sort of young man in a hurry, you just see each thing as an individual atomized thing and you go at it, bang your head on it and try and crack it. Now I think maybe it's just getting old and dull, but I just see everything has a much bigger context and it's explainable within that. And you can help understand the next bump in the road from the context of the last thing.
Do you have a favorite book?
So most of my reading is any biographies of financial biographies, financial stories for me is absolutely fascinating. If I had to read something else, it would probably be Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand, which was just a fascinating tale of human endeavor.
A favorite podcast?
Simon, yours.
The Money Maze podcast. That's very kind. Well, Peter, what a really great conversation. I've learned a lot and thank you for spending the time with us today. I'm going to take away two lessons, which is that great teams have lots of different perspectives, number one. And I think you're right on your last point, which is important to see the bigger context and the bigger picture as we go along. So, Peter Harrison, thank you very much for being a guest today.
Thank you, Simon. Enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.